Sairam, and good evening and a warm welcome to this week's episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. On behalf of all of us, I offer my humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. As you all know, this is a show where I invite questions from you listeners and answer them on the basis of Swami's message. Sometimes the questions are from Swami's message itself, or rather on Swami's message itself. Swami is a universal master. And as Professor Kasturi put it beautifully, he is here for awakening the sleeping, making the sitting stand, the standing to walk, the walking to reach. Which means one may be asleep to spirituality. Swami's messages awakens them, him or her, to spirituality. Some may want to follow, but are standing transfixed, not sure which direction to take. Swami's message is for such a person too. There may be those that are taking faltering steps on the spiritual path. Swami's message and words gives confidence to such people to walk firmly and even begin to run. And there are few amongst us who are already on the path and already progressing at a steady pace maybe. Swami's message provides the advanced training to such aspirants as well. Well, that is why Swami is the universal master. On one hand, we are lucky to have come to Swami, for he can guide us from the beginning to the very end. But on the other hand, we must understand that Swami's message has a context too. The science concept taught to a master student, however true it may be, cannot be taught to a class 1 student, isn't it? Similarly, the lesson that is taught to a beginner has a limited application which may not be applicable as it is for a higher understanding. And I guess this could cause us little confusion in trying to place and grasp Swami's message. But it is no big deal, because Swami is within and he is always there to guide us. If we look at Swami's message more intently, I believe he will certainly help us understand what we are meant to learn at that point in our journey. Nevertheless, when we look at various messages that Swami has given us, they may appear a bit contradictory to one another at times. I think we have had the opportunity to address a few such questions on this show, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to dwell on them with all of you. Today we have one such question which will give us the opportunity to explore a couple of Swami's teachings. But we are not there yet, isn't it? There are a few more minutes between us and the question and the answer. For now, it is time for this week's quote. Like last week, I once again have a quote from Vinoba Bhave, the great Gandhian freedom fighter, teacher and political activist. So here comes his words. I quote, "It is only when our life proceeds within bounds and in an accepted, disciplined way that the mind can be free." End of quote. Well, that is a concept I've spoken on many times before on this show. We could call it the discipline paradox. How do you become free? Be bound within limits of discipline and duty. Sounds just the opposite, right? But the idea is based on one fundamental principle we tend to forget. We are not the mind, but we use the mind. When we think that we are the mind, we seek freedom by seeking freedom for the mind. If we believe that we are not the mind, we will understand that our freedom is when the mind is under control and we are able to use it the way we choose. Let's say there is a wild horse. Freedom for the horse is when it is left in the meadows, allowed to graze wherever it wants, run when it feels like running, stand when it feels like. Now, if I say that I have to ride that horse, if it behaves the way it wants, then I don't have the freedom or choice of movement, isn't it? So the moment I see myself as not the horse, but the rider of the horse, then my control over the horse is the sign of my free will. Then I can say, I ride when I want, I go fast when I feel like, I slow down or halt when I want. So how do we get this control over the mind? It is through discipline, and as Vinoba Bhave puts it, in an accepted, disciplined way, which in other words means through the process of following our assigned duty at various stages of life. But unlike in the example of riding a horse, the mind itself does its best and outperforms itself when it is disciplined. That's why he says the mind itself can be freed through discipline. When the mind is disciplined, it can be freed from its waywardness and fickleness. Then the mind unleashes its true potential and becomes a far more effective tool. So disciplining the mind is necessary for any form of success, worldly or spiritual. If you have a water at point A, let's say, and you wish to take it to point B, we build a canal in such cases, right? That's what we generally do. If the distance between, say, point A and B is quite far, then I cannot afford to lose water in seepage when I build this canal. So I concretize the canal maybe, or maybe even waterproof it. If the distance is even further, then I can't afford to lose water even through evaporation. So I make a covered canal. Similarly in life too, if what we wish to achieve is worldly, then we need a certain amount of discipline. The discipline required for achieving a spiritual goal will be so much more because we are talking of a more intense journey. Well, whatever it may be, disciplining the mind is a very, very essential step in the path of life. So before we head to the question, permit me, dear listeners, to read out that quote by Vinoba Bhave one more time. I quote, "It is only when our life proceeds within bounds and in an accepted, disciplined way that the mind can be free." So let's then head to this week's question. The person who has asked us the question chooses to be anonymous, so we'll not name him. The question is a bit long. Actually, it's a abridged version of the explanation this person gave me over the mail. So I will read it out myself. The question is long, but I don't think the question as such is very complex, and I'm more than sure that many of you will be able to relate to this question too. So this is the question. I'll read it out as it is. Sairam, Mr. Prem, I am unable to understand two statements of Swami. One, speak obligingly, you need not always oblige. The second one, there should be unity of thought, word and deed. I find it difficult to practice these as I feel, of course incorrectly, that they are somewhat contradictory to each other. However well we clothe the truth sometimes, which is an art to be acquired in itself, the truth cannot be stomached always. For example, you tell a very obese friend of yours that she has to reduce her weight for her own good. It may be taken well or otherwise. Or say you object to certain policies in your organization because the past experiences tell you that they may not be beneficial in future and you care deeply for the organization. As far as possible, one can be diplomatic, but others getting hurt is really not in our hands, isn't it? Even a subtle negation is a no nevertheless, and it can be taken unkindly at times. I also believe and have been taught in my school and the Balvikas classes that one should be fearless when it comes to speaking the truth. We even had a hymn in school that goes, "It takes courage to risk your name, it takes courage to be true." I have also heard Swami say that one should be fearless when one has truth on one side, satyameva jayate, listen to your conscience, and so on. I heard you two saying that one should not keep quiet in two instances, either when something adharmic or immoral is occurring, or when it is one's duty to speak out. Can you please help me understand these two statements? Thanks in advance. So that is the question that this brother has asked us. A very interesting question. In fact, I had mentioned this a couple of weeks ago where I said I have this question coming up. How do you understand these two statements of always speak obligingly, you may not be able to oblige, and this very important concept that Swami speaks of unity of thought, word and deed, right? This is a very interesting concept. I think many people must be having this doubt. I've had this doubt myself. So it's a very interesting things, very interesting question. The question is more about how to follow this dictum of speak obligingly or pleasingly from the content of that question or the emphasis laid on this part of speaking obligingly or speaking the, or not speaking the unpleasant truth, right? That was the emphasis which was laid on the question. But what we will do is look at these two as separate messages of Swami. One is the unity of thought, word and deed. And the other thing is, it may not be always possible to oblige, but you can always speak obligingly. We'll talk of these two messages separately, but I would say that predominantly I'm going to stick to the unity of thought, word and deed, because in my understanding, I think that is a very, very fundamental message that Swami has given us. This journey in trying to achieve this unity of thought, word and deed is a more fundamental concept. And as I'm explaining, I think you will see that the other thing of how do you speak the truth in a pleasant manner, or how do you avoid speaking an unpleasant truth, and how that fits in into this larger concept of unity of thought, word and deed. I think that's what we'll try to do. So a major part of the answer I will dedicate to understanding this concept of unity of thought, word and deed. But I hope I will be able to convey the right answer for the question which was asked. But it'll be a little roundabout, so just giving you a heads up about that. Talking about this principle of unity of thought, word and deed, we all know that Swami has laid immense emphasis on this particular concept of unity of thought, word and deed. In fact, very recently I was going through a discourse where I came across this phrase where Swami was saying, the worst action that you can do is to do the opposite of what you preach. Swami says that's the worst kind of action that you can do. You say something, but you do something else. And of course, the other quote which we always know is when Swami says the unity of thought, word and deed is a sign of nobility, or a mahatma is identified by the unity of thought, word and deed. But one thing that whenever Swami is talking about this concept, Swami would use this phrase in Sanskrit which says Trikarna Shuddhi, right? Swami would say unity of thought, word and deed in English, but when he's referring to that very phrase in Sanskrit, Swami would say Trikarna Shuddhi. And Shuddhi does not mean unity, but Shuddhi means purity. So maybe Swami is hinting that when there is purity in thought, word and deed, automatically there will be unity. In fact, that's again a different quote from Swami where he says that, you know, the moment impurities are removed, automatically unity will come. Or when there is unity, there will be purity and there will be divinity. We've come across those quotes many times. But this is an interesting point that we need to note. We will understand why Swami is laying this emphasis, that it's important to see unity of thought, word and deed as also unity and purity of thought, word and deed, right? Because Swami says that Sanskrit sentence which I said, Swami would talk about the quality of a Mahatma is unity of thought, word and deed. Swami would say, Vachasyekam, Manasyekam, Vachasyekam, Karmanyekam, Mahatmanam, Manas Anyat, Vachas Anyat, Karman Anyat, Duratmanam. We've heard this repeated by Swami n number of times, and there will be so much of emphasis when Swami says this. And many, many times, I can't tell you enough how much this is important, right? How important this particular statement of Swami is, because he's made a mention of it so many times. So many people ask this question of, you know, if we are supposed to have unity of thought, word and deed. So if I have a bad thought, and if I speak out that bad thought, and if I act according to that bad thought, will that lead to me being a noble person or me being a Mahatma? Can you even think of calling a person who has an impure thought and who implements an impure thought as a Mahatma? And just because there is unity of thought, word and deed, certainly not. I mean, there's no question of that being there, right? And that's why here the definition that Swami is using for a noble soul, a Mahatma, is very important. Mahatma is already somebody whom we refer to as a noble person. Which means we, when we look at somebody and say, oh, he's a Mahatma or he's a very noble person, we automatically know that that person has a certain amount of goodness. But what Swami is doing is, just appearing good or just being good is not good enough. A true Mahatma is one who has unity of thought, word and deed, which means that purity is not only there in the action and words, but it is also there in the level of the thought. And that is why Swami is saying, so the question of, can I have a bad thought and then can I speak it out and can I act according to that does not arise at all. We are talking about what is perfect purity. That perfect purity is when there is purity in the thought and that is expressed in words and is also expressed in action, right? So I feel in this context, one who appears to be good and one who speaks as though he is noble, but the thoughts and intentions are evil, such a person becomes what Swami is referring to as Duratma, right? When Swami is defining a Mahatma, he is saying that he has purity in thought, word and deed. But a person who appears to be pure, who speaks very nobly and who acts or pretends to be very noble, but in the mind the intentions and the thoughts running are bad, Swami says such a person is doing nothing but making a pretense. He's showing you something which he really is not or she is really not. So Swami says that this is nothing but a form of cheating the person in front of you. So Swami is referring to this quality as Duratma. As we go through, we'll see that this is what it is. But we all do this thing of filtering the thoughts which come to us. We do not speak everything that comes to our mind, isn't it? I mean, that's a sign of a person who is more cultured, a person who is more balanced, right? And we do not do everything that we feel like. So does that make us a Duratma? Because there is a disharmony between what is there in our head and what is that we speak and what is that we do, right? And this is where the doubt about speaking obligingly and putting forth the truth in a very diplomatic manner and not putting it directly. So are you indulging in disharmony of thought, word and deed? Well, I don't think so. And this is where people also tend to think that spirituality is a form of hypocrisy, or you know, people are being hypocritical in the name of spirituality or following Swami's message. Because in the mind there are all kinds of thoughts, but they pretend as though they are very noble and they do only good things. And I mean, I've come across many people who say this, that people who follow spirituality are all very hypocritical because they put up a show of goodness, but you know, their mind is as dirty as everybody else. So let's try and understand what Swami actually means by disharmony and harmony in this particular context from whatever we have spoken so far. So one thing is clear, that this is relating to the idea of becoming pure in the path of spirituality. And that's why this is a very, very fundamental thing. And Swami is referring to the unity of thought, word and deed. And when Swami defines a Mahatma as someone who has unity of thought, word and deed, that is like the pinnacle. That's like the state where we want to reach, where what we think and what we speak and what we do are completely in harmony and we do not have any kind of fallout between these three instruments of expression, right? So the first point when we're talking about this journey of trying to reach that unity of thought, word and deed, the first point is the acknowledgement of what is good and bad, right? That is the first thing. After we recognize what is it that we must do, that is when the whole process starts. So the question of, I'm having a bad thought, can I express it and can I speak about it, does not occur at all. We first of all acknowledge that the right thing has to be done, the right thing has to be spoken and the right thing has to be thought. So the acknowledgement of what is good and what is not good is the first point. Now, the idea of goodness has three varying levels of ease, if I may put it that way. The easiest way of goodness is to speak like you're very good, right? And that's where the whole idea of Swami referring to you speak one thing and do one thing comes. To profess to others, to teach others is actually very, very easy. You know, when I read a Swami's message or when I learn about a spiritual concept, the easiest way to express that good idea that I have inculcated in me is to speak about it, right? A little more difficult than that is to act according to that. Like, suppose I talk of a concept of surrender, you know, that's something which we often speak about on the radio. We give talks and lectures, we invariably talk about the idea of surrender, right? And we always speak about how surrender is, this is how you should do, Swami says this. The easiest thing is to take the concept of surrender and give a speech about that. But a little more difficult than that is at a point when we are supposed to act, we are able to act according to that concept that we are talking. And a little more difficult than even acting is to not have any hesitation in the mind at all. So goodness in the mind is the most difficult. The easiest is to profess, easiest is to express in the form of words. A little more difficult is to act according to that concept that we have learned. And much, much more difficult is the ability to constantly remain in that state of goodness in the mind. So that's why I'm saying that when we're talking about goodness, there are three levels based on the ease. Easiest is to speak. A little more difficult is to act according to it. And much, much more difficult is your spontaneous thinking is also based on that idea that you have learned. And always in spirituality, the key word when you're talking about progress in spirituality, I often say this, the key word is spontaneity, or the how natural that goodness is. When we are becoming good, one thing is with difficulty I might be good, but when I'm progressing on this path and trying to become more good, that goodness becomes more natural and spontaneous. That is the best sign to show that you are progressing in life, right? And how do we know that our goodness is spontaneous or natural? Invariably, we will know when we are put through situations where this goodness that we have acquired or this goodness which we think that we have is tested. And very broadly putting it in two categories, in two circumstances, our natural or spontaneous goodness is often tested. One, when in adversity or when we are in a crisis situation, right? Because when we are in a stressful situation, as we have spoken about many times before, that's when you actually start behaving, you act to protect your interests, right? That's what you do when you're under stress. And when you start trying to act to protect your interests, that is when your real nature comes out, right? So when in an adversity or when in a situation of stress, that is when you start acting according to your true nature. It could either be a real situation of stress or it could even be a perceived situation of stress. And that's what happens most of the time. We think that we are under threat. We're not necessarily always under pressure, but we think that we're under pressure and we end up, doing something like this. We start behaving more selfishly. The second place where our goodness is tested, whether it is natural and spontaneous, is when there is no reward for being good, right? A good practical scenario for that is when you're interacting with a person who probably cannot give you anything in return. When you're interacting with a person who is lower than you in authority and power, there is nothing that this person can give me. There's nothing of worth and value that I can gain from this person. At such a situation, the way we behave is a true sign of our true nature, right? And that is why it is said the two ways our real goodness is tested is when we are going through adversity and when we are given power and authority. When there are more people who are under us, there are more people who are dependent on us, but we are not dependent on them. When this attitude is there, how do I act? How do I treat my subordinates? How do I treat those people who are lower in the ladder of authority in reference to me, right? So these are the two situations where our true natural goodness is tested. So that's what we are all endeavoring to achieve, right? And if we reach the state of true goodness that I'm talking about, automatically there will be unity of thought, word, and deed. Because if I am truly good, and if I have nothing to receive from you, and I'm still good, and if in any situation, put under any crisis, I am still doing the good thing, I mean, it goes without saying that the thoughts in my head are good, right? So the best way in which to see whether we are having that perfect unity of thought, word, and deed is when we are tested in this manner, when we are tested through adversity and crisis and stress, when we are put through situations where we are in a position of power and authority, or we are in the presence of people who cannot contribute to us in any way, and how we behave in their presence, right? And when we are good in such situations, it goes without saying that we are good naturally, which means even in our thoughts where there is nobody to witness, where there is nobody to look at us and say that you're good or bad, we will automatically be good. It goes without saying. And that flows into our actions and words, right? So this is the state we are all trying to achieve. So now the question is, what is the path to this state of goodness? How do we get to this place where we are noble spontaneously, we are noble under all circumstances? The mind is very complex, and I don't have to tell you that. You all know that very well. The mind is filled with all kinds of thoughts, right? And just a few minutes with our mind, with nobody around, we are just observing our mind, we can know that there are all kinds of thoughts which flow in the mind. Like you have low and unpleasant desires, you have noble desires, you might have fears, you might have selfish thoughts, you also have selfless thoughts. There is anger, hatred, but at the same time there is thoughts of love, there's thoughts of compassion, there's thoughts of sympathy, there's thoughts of real goodness, right? So that's the case with most of us. Our mind is a mix of all of these kind of thoughts. And actually speaking, we don't have much control over what we think. Most of the time, these thoughts just keep coming and coming and coming. And based on the situations we are in, based on what we are going through life, we actually don't have much control over the thoughts that come into our mind, right? Let's say that we have come in contact with Swami and we've come in contact with Swami's message, right? And we have read that these are the kind of good thoughts that you should have. Swami says you should not have jealousy, you should not have greed. Though I know now what is the right thing to do and what are the right kinds of thoughts to have, it's not good to be jealous, it's not good to have anger, it's not good to have hatred, I cannot choose to just switch off the bad thoughts, right? It doesn't work that way. And that's probably the most frustrating thing, that you know what is right and wrong, but still spontaneously some of these thoughts keep coming. And our thoughts actually arise from what Swami would refer to as the subconscious mind, where we don't know what is the cause for these thoughts to come, which Swami says is built over many, many lifetimes. So there is this source of all these thoughts. One source is the subconscious mind, where we have no control over. It keeps flowing from there. But a part of it we know, which is the conscious mind, which we are interacting with people around, and things keep coming in our mind. And that is one part of the mind we know. Okay, this has come because I was in this situation this morning, and that's why this anger is there or this irritation is there. Sometimes, or most times, the cause for some of our thoughts are unknown to us, right? So when we want to purify our mind, what do we do? We can't switch off the bad thoughts. So what is the process in which, through which we can purify this mind? Well, right now, we all know that in India, we're trying to clean up some of our big rivers, which are highly polluted, and sadly so. For instance, you have the Ganga or Yamuna, and we're trying to purify them. You know, the process of purifying a river like that is actually pretty simple. The first thing is, you have to stop the waste from being dumped into the river, because that's the main problem that we're having. Many of the industries, start throwing in waste, which is coming right out of the industrial waste just goes into these rivers. So if you're looking at cleaning a river like this, the first thing what we do is we try to either stop these industrial waste from going into the river, or the second option is they treat the waste before it is put into the river, so that the river has a little bit of space for it to work on this. I mean, if it's completely and very, very toxic, the river finds it very difficult to purify, but it's treated to a certain extent and then allowed into the river. The river takes care of itself. It has an ability to purify itself, right? So we do the same thing with the mind. The first point we need to do is start checking the kind of things that enter the mind. What, whom, and where we spend our time. Avoid those places, avoid those people, and avoid those kind of inputs that can pollute the mind, right? So that is the first thing that we need to do, just like how when you're talking about clearing a river or cleaning up a river. The next is we try to be in the company of good, right? One is you stop bad from going inside the mind. The second thing is, can you bring in good into the mind? And that happens through satsang, or the company of the good. And when we say satsang, it's not just people who are good. It could be people, it could be books, it could be all other kinds of inputs that we take in, right? So one is either the first step is you stop bad things from entering. And if you cannot stop completely, Swami says, you treat what comes inside. And Swami would often say that one of the ways, you eat all kinds of food, you have no control over the purity of the food that you eat. So you treat the food before it goes inside. What you do, you chant Brahmarpanam. And, that is one process which Swami gives. So one thing is you stop bad from entering. And then you bring in good inputs through the process of satsang. And now satsang works in two ways. One, as I said, it regulates the input. The kind of things that go inside become noble. The second way it works is, it's the same way peer pressure works. Peer pressure works in a negative sense, but the same thing satsang does, but in a positive influence, right? Like when teenagers go into wrong company, let's say, then they come under the influence of peer pressure, they have to act in a certain way. Probably they take to some habits which they didn't have otherwise, or they sometimes end up spending more to appear rich when they are in the company of such friends. So the peer pressure makes them do things in a certain way, which probably they would not have done if they were not in the company of those people. In the same way, when we are in good company, we try to keep up being good with the people around us. Well, actually, that is the dangerous part. I'll come to that in the end, but it also helps in a certain way. You're being in the company of good. You have an inspiration and you have an encouragement to do the right thing and speak the right thing. So it works in two ways. One is the input which goes in starts getting purified, and it also gives you an environment where goodness is valued and you have an incentive to be good. So what we'll do is, let me first explain how being in satsang is supposed to help in this whole process of purifying the mind. And if you've lost track of what we were going through, we are trying to look at how do you make a person spontaneously good. Not a person spontaneously good, how do we become spontaneously good? That's the idea. And the idea is, when the thoughts get purified, automatically what gets expressed will become pure in the form of words. What gets expressed in action becomes pure. So the whole idea is to purify this mind to become spontaneously good. So one of the things is, you stop bad from entering inside. You stop the wrong kind of influences. The second thing is satsang. And I'm now going to talk about how this satsang is supposed to influence this mind and this process of purifying the mind. We started by saying that we have all kinds of thoughts and we cannot wish away the bad ones however much we want to. So we use our buddhi or our intellect as a kind of a filter, right? That's the whole process in spirituality Swami speaks about. Now this discrimination or this buddhi of what is good and what is bad is influenced by the company we keep and the inputs I take in, right? So when I constantly listen to Swami's discourses, or right now you're listening to Radio Sai, you kind of listen to that kind of input which empowers your buddhi or enhances the ability of your buddhi to make the right decision, right? So this buddhi is the filter which tells you, okay, these are the kind of thoughts that can be expressed in words and action. Now when you turn to satsang, you start empowering this buddhi. So the buddhi starts becoming more and more primed to make this decision of, this is right, this is wrong, this thought can be expressed, or this thought should be expressed, right? So one, we have stopped more crap from... going into our mind. We take in good inputs that empower the buddhi. And now we start filtering the flow of thoughts through this filter of buddhi and only permit those that are worthy to become actions and words to express themselves as actions and words. And this is a very, very important step. Because remember, I told you about the subconscious mind and how the most of our thoughts come from there and we have no control over it. Swami says the more and more we start giving expression to good thoughts in the form of words and actions, Swami says this will very, very slowly start purifying the subconscious mind. The only way we have to purify the subconscious mind is by constantly filtering out bad thoughts and giving expression to good thoughts. Now, this is how the subconscious mind gets purified over a long period of time. And what does that happen? Going back to the same analogy of a river, One thing is we have stopped bad things from going inside. The other thing is we are probably putting things which will purify the river, if there's anything like that. I'm not sure of that. And you are also trying another method by which you are purifying the source of the water itself, if there is any way. I'm just giving you this analogy. I'm not telling that it's exactly how the purification of rivers happen. So just think of it as happening in our mind. One thing is we stop bad things from entering. The second thing is we ensure that good things go in. And these good things empower this buddhi, which is a filter. So more and more good thoughts start getting expression. And when these good thoughts get expression in the form of words and actions, they influence this subtle part or the subconscious part of the mind, which we otherwise don't have access to. And it starts purifying this. And Swami would also use the word vasanas, right? This is built over many, many lifetimes. So over a very, very slow process of giving expression to good thoughts, Swami says that it restructures this subtle part. And this is what Swami would often speak of as the four-step process of purification in the path of spirituality. One is tyaja durjana samsargam, which is stop bad influences, bhaja sadhu samagamam, go and have the company of those things which are noble. And the third thing is, very beautifully, Swami says, Kuru Punya Mahoratram. Do good actions day and night. The more expression you give to good thoughts, the more expression that you give to good feelings and intentions, Swami says that you are purifying the source for all these thoughts. And of course, the fourth step is Smaranitya Anityatam. That's a different concept. I'll not bring it here because it might complicate. But we have spoken about that many times before, how that actually enhances this buddhi in a very, very beautiful way. We'll not go into that. So these three steps, tyaja durjana samsargam, avoid bad company, bhaja sadhu samagamam, have good company, and kuru punya mahoratram, give expression to more and more good thoughts and feelings. And during this process, one thing that might happen is we may appear hypocritical, right? Say I do this whole thing perfectly, whatever this whole process that I spoke about, I am always filtering out bad thoughts and I'm giving expression only to good thoughts. Now when you look at me, you will say that, oh, you're a very good person. But I am only privy to the thoughts in my mind. And I might feel that you're looking at my actions and words and saying that I'm a good person, but you know, you have no idea what's running in my mind. There are all kinds of thoughts running in my mind. So in such cases, when we look at ourselves, it might feel like, you know, there is disharmony between thought, word and deed, or I am being hypocritical, but this is not disharmony in thought, word and deed. It is just being in the process. And this is a very, very slow process, as I said, because you are trying to correct your vasanas, which is not very easy. So though it is very easy to explain in the course of 10, 20 minutes, I've explained it to you. When we go through this, many times we falter, right? Many times we intake unavoidable, unpleasant inputs because of our circumstances, because of our weaknesses, because of our failures. How much ever we try, you know, in today's world of media, we consume a lot of things that we probably should not. But when we keep trying, when the direction that we are taking is towards this idea of purifying this mind through this process, I think it may appear that we are having a disharmony in thought, word, and deed. But as long as the direction is the same, we are actually heading towards the right direction. So what then is this idea of disharmony in thought, word, and deed that Swami refers to as being a duratma and we need to refrain from? It is not this process of filtering, right? So if you're thinking that this, you know, I have many thoughts in my mind, I'm filtering out the bad thoughts and I'm giving expression only to good thoughts, am I being hypocritical? Is there disharmony between thought, word, and deed? No, this is not what Swami is referring to. This is the process towards harmony of thought, word, and deed. We should never stop this. Even if we feel discouraged, Swami says you should never stop this. You slowly keep working on this till a point where the source itself starts getting purified and spontaneously you keep getting good thoughts. The spring of your thoughts starts, you've purified that source itself. So all the thoughts that you get are noble. And automatically the noble thoughts start getting expressed in word and deed. And there's always that unity of thought, word and deed. That's why Swami refers to that as Trikarna Shuddhi. So it starts with the mind. And it starts with when you take a message, you ruminate over it. And you correct the source itself, which is the thoughts. And the filtering happens in the mind itself. So this is the process. So now the question is, what is this disharmony in thought, word, and deed that Swami refers to and Swami does not want us to indulge in? I said one way that satsang helps is it purifies the input which goes into our mind and it empowers the buddhi. The other effect that it creates is a positive way of peer pressure, right? That's what I mentioned. So now going back to this idea of being good, right? When I started, I said there are three levels of being good. The easiest is just to speak out whatever has gone into your head, whatever you've learned, just speak it out, just profess it, just give talks about it, like what I'm doing right now maybe. The more difficult thing is when put in that situation, act according to what you've learned. And even more difficult is to have goodness in thoughts. You automatically, spontaneously, you have only good thoughts. That's a very, very advanced stage of the journey that we're all going in, right? So when I read a spiritual literature or that I've heard enough of spiritual discourses of Swami, the easiest way for me to show my learning is to go about talking to everybody, right? Or act in a good manner when people are watching me, right? It's not only about speaking, but when I'm being observed, when I'm in the presence of others, I carry myself like a very noble person. I carry myself like a very spiritually advanced person. And doing this is actually not very difficult, right? So what we are doing is the difficult part is to purify this mind itself, to influence this buddhi, to do the filtering there. But the easy part is to act and to speak like a good person. So when I said that being in good company is like a positive form of peer pressure, so you are there, I mean, you're forced to perform and show that you're good, right? So some of us may resort to the easier form of goodness or easier form of appearing good. We don't do this whole process that I spoke about, that constantly you're asking what is good, what is wrong, what am I supposed to do, what am I not supposed to do, what is my duty, am I doing the right thing? And you are filtering your thoughts, and it's a long process. Instead of doing that, we start taking to the easy path, right? So that is the dangerous part which Swami says is bad. And even worse is if we do this with the wrong intention, right? If you're doing it with the idea that let people get cheated that I'm good and, you know, you want to may take advantage of that in some form. There are many, many people who are doing that, right? Let's not go into that. So this is what Swami very, very vehemently says is a very bad nature. Duratmanam, Swami says. And whenever Swami would say that, he would say it with so much emphasis, right? So when you learn a spiritual message, when you take Swami's message and you start ruminating over it, instead of thinking about it, making it a part of your mental process, and then you start letting that seep into your actions and words, we take it and we directly only speak it, we directly only profess it to others, and we pretend that we are doing it when others are observing, but we have actually not taken the effort to correct our thinking. Swami says that is the most dangerous thing. And this invariably is tested, as I said, through the process of adversity and power. So if a person is pretending to be good only in words and action, when this person is put in a situation of stress or adversity, or when this person is put in a situation of power or authority, automatically the selfishness which is inherent is going to show up in some form or the other, right? And that is where that person is not spontaneously good or spontaneously noble. In fact, if you look at it, this idea of unity of thought, word, indeed, this process is what Swami said is the necessary thing. And even before Swami actually sang Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam, we often refer to that as Swami's first message. But Swami's real first message is unity of thought, word, indeed. Because even when he was in school, we all know that Swami staged that beautiful drama of Chipinar to Chestara. The message of that is, is your actions in harmony with your words? Is your thoughts in harmony with what you say and speak, right? So this is very, very important. So it all comes down to the intention, right? So in the process of this whole thing which we were speaking about, there are many times when, you know, there could be all kinds of thoughts in my head, but I don't give expression to them. So in the process, it might look like there's disharmony between thought, word, and deed. But if my direction is in the right, if my movement is in the right direction, then I think even though it appears like there's this harmony in thought, word, and deed, I don't have to worry about that because the intention is right. On the other hand, if out of selfishness, if I'm trying to put a pretense of a different kind outside, but I'm not doing this whole process inside, I think that is when it becomes very, very important. So it all comes down to the intention with which it is done. And when we often talk about goodness, one of the basic definitions of goodness is this constant desire not to hurt or harm another person, right? Whatever I do, whatever I speak, it should not hurt another person in any way. And I think this is where the idea of always speaking obligingly comes, right? That's the second part of the question. I don't know how much time I have for that. So when you're talking about speaking obligingly, it comes down to this idea of my acts and words should not hurt another person in any form, right? So now when you look at it, this whole process of stopping bad from going inside and getting good inputs and influencing your buddhi, and this filter that we have of what are the thoughts, what gets expressed as words and what gets expressed as action, this idea of speaking obligingly, which Swami says in the context of as much as possible, don't hurt others with your words, right? That is where this message of Swami fits in. So this also becomes one of the other filters that we need to apply in our mind when we talk about buddhi. That's why I said this is a subset of this concept of thought, word, and deed. So one of the filters that we have to apply when we are trying to sort out what are the thoughts which needs to find expression as words is this message of Swami, which Swami says, you know, you may not be always be able to oblige. You need to always speak obligingly. But why does Swami say that you can't always oblige? Because we can't do anything and everything, right? That's the whole idea. Because we are filtering out our actions through this filter of buddhi. So we can't always oblige. If somebody comes and asks us for a favor, either that favor, we are not in a position to do that favor because of our circumstances, or we are not, it is not our dharma or our duty to do that particular favor that person is asking, right? And that person may not think of it in that way. He may not be aware of a situation he's asking, or that person is just asking us for something. So when we have figured out that that is not something that I can do or I'm not supposed to do, Swami says, use this filter of, yes, not all your, whoever asks you for anything, you cannot do that, but you can always speak obligingly, right? So this is the filter Swami says that you have to use. When we are acting, we constantly have to think that, is this something that Swami has approved us to do? Is this something that is okay to do? In fact, one of the very beautiful and practical tips which Swami would often give us as students is, you know, Swami would say that now you're all Swami students, I'm talking to you every day, I've given you I've given you the understanding of what is good and bad. Swami would say that, but when you go back home, out of their love, your parents will tell you that, you know, why didn't you relax a bit? Why didn't you go for a cinema? Why didn't you, you know, go and socialize with your old friends? So Swami would say that, see, that is an act that you're not supposed to do, because Swami has given you the understanding that that is something that you should not do, right? But Swami says, you don't have to tell your parents that, no, how dare you tell me to do all wrong things? Don't you know that Swami does not want you to do? So Swami would say that don't do the act, but you say no to your parents in as pleasing a way as possible. Because that was a very practical message that Swami gave, right? So you use this concept of you cannot always oblige, but you speak obligingly whenever possible in that scenario, right? So what you express in action is always based on what is Swami's expectation of us, or what is our idea of what is a noble act and what is a good act and what is an appropriate act. But when we have filtered out some acts as inappropriate and we cannot act, we can always speak to that person obligingly, right? So that is where this concept of speak obligingly comes in. In fact, if I could just extend that a little bit, sometimes Swami says that you can use words where you don't want to act in a harsh sense also. The other Chinnakatha which Swami would say is about a snake which attends a satsang of a great sage, and that sage is saying that you should never harm anybody, you should never hurt anybody. So, you know, this snake. The story goes that the snake takes this message to heart and says that I've been biting all people. I should no more harm anybody. So it goes back to its hole in the village and it becomes a very calm snake. So the moment the snake becomes calm and does not harm anybody, people around it start becoming bold. They start bullying the snake. They start throwing stones into its anthill or start beating it up. So one day the snake, all battered and full of injuries, it comes to the sage and it tells that, you know what, I heard your discourse and I thought I'm not going to indulge in any form of violence. So I decided not to bite or harm anybody, but see what has happened to me. So then the sage tells the snake that, I mean, I told you not to bite, but I didn't tell you not to hiss. Right? You can always scare people away. So this is a case where, you know, you have to do something which may be painful, but Swami says that instead of doing the act which could harm the person, you use your words and you use harsh words in that scenario, this might be a better option to do. So when Swami says always speak obligingly, I hope you understand where, how limited that particular message of Swami is. And as Swami would often say, you know, when you're talking about parents, when you're talking about teachers, this idea of how do you use your words, where do you be strict? Swami does not say that you can always be kind, you should always be calm and, you know, loving when you're bringing up children. Swami says, no, sometimes you have to be firm, right? But what happens is there is no concept of absoluteness in this idea of always speak obligingly. When Swami gives this message, as I said, it becomes one more filter that we have in our mind. And constantly we see in every situation, okay, this is what I have to convey to this person. Swami says, speak obligingly. Can I make my word a little more pleasing than I would have made it otherwise, right? So it's not that my speaking obligingly will be exactly the same way as your way of speaking obligingly, but at least can I make mine a little more pleasant than it would have been otherwise. Right, that is what we do when we listen to Swami's message, right? So you take Swami's message, you make it a part of your thinking, you make it a part of your mananam, and you filter out your actions and words accordingly, right? So that is what we generally tend to do. Now the part of, you know, the very important thing that you raised, that is it in our control whom we please and whom we hurt, right? It's certainly not in our control, right? And to a certain extent, we can keep that as a way to guide our words, that, you know, if I say this to this person, it might hurt this person, so let me put it in a more softer way. Or you, depending on the person you're interacting with, somebody is more sensitive than others. So to the sensitive person, you become a little more careful with your words, right? So to a little extent, the nature of the person you're interacting with can define the way you express your words. The same truth can be expressed in different ways. Like, that's what most doctors do. If they find that the patient is a very brave patient, then they put forth the truth in a more pragmatic way. But if they, in the interaction, they find that the patient is a very hypertensive patient and he gets very tensed, gets very worried, then they will mellow down what they're telling to that particular patient in a manner that it suits that patient. To an extent, you can do that. But as you said, we have no control over how our words are perceived by the other person. At the end of it, that person might still get hurt, that person might still be, worried, take it in a wrong sense. That is why there is no one way of doing it. Sometimes, you know, who says it also matters, right? I don't know, how do I explain that? In fact, there's one beautiful episode that one of the lecturers was once sharing with us. And this person happened to be the principal in one of Swami's educational institutions. And one devotee came up to him for the admission of his son. Apparently, this devotee has gone to Swami and he said that, Swami, my son is finishing his particular course and he would like to become Swami's student. Swami said, very good. And, you know, go and meet the principal and let him write the entrance exam, let him get in. So this boy goes, father takes the son to this principal and tells him that, you know, he's my son and I would like to put him in Swami's educational institution. So very duly they make him write the entrance exam. And they find that this student is not, has not qualified through the exam. He does not have the marks to get into the institute, as well as he's not done well in the entrance exam. So the principal tells the father that, you know, he's not done well. I can't take him in. So, but the father is very insistent. He says, please, sir, I would like to put him here. I would like my son to become Swami student. You know, that'll make his life so noble and all of those things he said. So out of his concern, the principal told him that, see, technically I can't take him because he's not cleared the entrance and he does not have the marks. But if you go and ask Swami, and if Swami says that, yes, take him, then I will take him, right? So this person is very happy. So I can do that. I'll go and ask Swami in the mandir. So he went up to Swami, and during the darshan, he went and asked Swami, and he said, Swami, the principal told me that if you say yes, then he will take. So I've come to you. So Swami listened to that person very calmly, and Swami came out, and then Swami called the principal. And Swami asked him, what did you tell this gentleman who came with his son? So this elderly lecturer, he said, Swami, this is what I said. This is the advice I gave. Then after that, he got a real dressing down from Swami. Swami was so upset with him. But what Swami said was very, very beautiful and I think very profound. Swami said, see, this boy has not qualified to become a student in our institute because of the marks, right? I know it. When the father came and told me that I want to put my son in your school, I know that this boy cannot join our school. But see, I am their guru. I am their God. They look at me, I am Swami for them, right? If I say a no to them, they will not look at it as Swami has said no for their institute. For them, that no means a lot of things, right? Swami has rejected me. Oh my God, Swami does not like me. Or they could think any kind of things when Swami says a no. But as an administrator, when you say a no and you put your foot down and say that no, he cannot come, Swami says they will look at it as, okay, you know, you have rejected it. Otherwise, when I say a no, they will take it as a rejection from me. So I thought that was a very, very beautiful message that Swami is giving. So when we're talking about how do you diplomatically put forth a truth which is unpleasant, I think these are the things that we have to keep in mind. Is it so necessary for me to tell this thing? Will telling this benefit the other person in any way? Or will somebody else telling it benefit the person better? Yes, this is the truth. I can tell it to that person. I am not afraid. I am not worried about my image or what will that person think of me. I'm not worried about anything. This is the truth. I have to tell it to that person. Can we think that will this truth benefit that person by me telling it, or will it benefit that person by someone else telling it? Right? And these are very, very subtle things. And that's why I said it all boils down to intention. And that intention is I should not harm the other person and I should benefit the other person as much as possible. Right? That's the whole definition. Paropakaraya punyaya papaya parapidanam. Constantly wonder whether this person will benefit out of what I'm saying. If it is not going to benefit that person, if it is going to anger that person in such a manner that it might backfire, then what's the point? Even if it is true, even if you have no worry in telling it, what is the point of conveying a truth like that? And after all this, you might say something and it might be misunderstood. I think that is not in our control, right? We can only think of as much as what we can do. I think probably I could put it as, let's say that there is an unpleasant truth that you have to convey, be it to like the scenarios that you pointed out. There's an obese friend that you want to convey it to that person so that that person takes corrective action. Or in an organization, something is going wrong and you want to put your foot down and say this is wrong. Probably these four questions, if we could ask, I'm just given four questions. It could be more complex than this depending on the situation that a person is going through. We can ask ourselves, one, will I be failing in my duty if I don't speak up? That's the first thing. And I think this is probably the most fundamental, as you yourself mentioned in the answer. I've mentioned this many times before in the course of many answers. So the first thing is ask yourself, will I be failing in my duty if I don't speak up? Number two, am I not speaking the truth because of fear or because of selfishness? This again is a very, very fundamental point. I think it will work for most of the scenarios. Am I not choosing to speak the truth, which is unpleasant, because of fear of any kind or a selfishness of any kind? What will that person think of me, or what will happen to my image in the organization? Or, oh, I will be looked at in such and such a manner, or the superior will mark me out and I will be given a bad deal when I have to go through my promotion, whatever it is, any situation like that, right? you might go through a process. You might ask this question that, let me not tell the truth because of this. So the second thing is, am I not speaking the truth because of fear or selfishness? The third thing, what I mentioned just a while ago, am I the best person, and is this the best time to say this for the best outcome? Right? Am I the best person to speak this truth, and is this the most appropriate time to speak this truth? I think if we can ask these questions, and if we are sure that we are not hesitating to speak the truth because we don't want to hurt the other person, it's not going to benefit the other person, it's not going to benefit the whole organization, the whole code, we don't have to think that this is a form of disharmony of thought, word, and deed. The main reason being, see, when I say that I don't want to hurt the other person, that also becomes part of my thinking, right? So I have many thoughts in my mind, and I'm taking this thought, which is more important, which is Swami's message. I'm saying that I don't want to hurt the other person. So this becomes my thought. I don't want to, other person becomes my thought. So accordingly, I construct my words. Accordingly, I act. So where is the question of disharmony of thought, word, and deed? You are only giving priority to some thoughts which deserve that priority because they are noble thoughts. Right? So this is what I thought of giving an answer to this question, because it's a very, very important question. I am not really sure if I've done justice to the question. I think the listeners will only be able to tell me that. But I hope I've given you some points to think of. This is a fundamental process, especially what I spoke about thought, word, and deed, is a process that is happening with all of us. And it is given, we are given to a lot of self-doubt in the process. I think that is something we have to get over. And as Swami said, Tyajadurjana Samsargam, Bhaja Sadhu Samagamam, Kuru Punya Mahuratram. Do good day and night. Keep away from bad company. Try to take good inputs inside your mind and give expression to good thoughts as much as possible. The last message which Swami would say, that when Ravana is dying, Rama tells Lakshmana, you go and ask him, he's a great soul. You ask him for his last message, and the last message that Ravana gives is, when you have a good thought, implement it immediately. If you have a bad thought, try to hold it away as much as possible, right? That is the message which is important. And in the process, it may appear that there is disharmony between thought, word, and deed, but it is not actually disharmony in thought, word, and deed. So I hope I've given something to think about. Thank you for asking this question. And if you have anything more to ask, you can always write to me at prema@radiosai.org. Okay, it's time for me to wrap up. I've taken a little bit of extra time. I thank you all for your patient listening. I offer this answer and this entire program at Swami's Lotus Feet. If you have a question that you'd like me to address on this show, you know what to do. You have to send me a mail at prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID, so confidentiality is guaranteed. And if you don't want your name to be mentioned like this, the questioner of today, you can let me know. If you can record your question in your own voice and send it across, it would be brilliant. I'd always love to play it in the voice of the questioner. I'm going to leave you with a very, very beautiful song. It's the month of April, and how much ever we try to not think of it, I think we think of the events that happened 7 years ago. And I think this song perfectly describes the emotions that arise in us when we think of the happenings of April of 2011. I'm going to leave you with this song. On the other side of the song, as always, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and Sai Prakash for the last segment of this week's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai, Answering Both.
Oh, ye dukh सहाना जाए हाय रा याद साई की आए याद साई की आए याद साई की आए ये दुख सहाना जाए सहाना जाए हाय राम याद साईं के आए याद दरस बिना कछुना भावे दरस बिना मुहे कछुना भावे मुझ बिरहन का जियरा जलावे साई बिन रहना जाए साई बिन रहना जाए हाय राम याद साई